Good morning, all. Our first case for argument this morning is Independent Trust v. Stewart Information. Mr. Merrill.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Adam Merrill, and I represent PricewaterhouseCoopers as the receiver for Independent Trust Corporation. This receivership arose because the owners and directors of Intrust, Lawrence Capriotti and Jack Hargrove, took over $40 million from Intrust account holders, deposited the funds into the Intercounty Titles escrow account, and subsequently paid tens of millions of dollars to the Stewart defendants or to others for Stewart's benefit. To fully appreciate how the district court erred, it is important to understand exactly what the receiver has alleged in its complaint, and I would like to emphasize five critical facts. Number one, by early 1990, Stewart knew of a $25.8 million escrow shortage at Intercounty, much of which had been caused by criminal conduct of Capriotti and Hargrove. Stewart knew this from reading Intercounty's annual audited financial statements. To give just one example of these escrow abuses, Intercounty took $1 million in escrow funds and used it to buy an office building. This money was never returned to the escrow. And there's a transcript from an Intercounty shareholder meeting where Stewart's current CEO admitted he knew about this, what was a criminal use of escrow funds. Number two, because Capriotti, Hargrove, and Intercounty lacked the resources to fill the escrow hole, and Stewart knew it, Stewart was liable as a title insurer for the missing escrow funds. Number three, by 1990, Stewart and Intercounty, by and through Capriotti and Hargrove, knowingly and voluntarily agreed to run Intercounty's escrow account on the float so that Stewart wouldn't have to fill the hole itself. This is just the sort of embezzlement by a crooked escrowee that this court has previously condemned in the TRW Title Insurance Company case. Number four, Stewart pressured Capriotti and Hargrove to fill the hole in the escrow account with funds not insured by Stewart. And number five, Capriotti and Hargrove in fact filled the hole in the escrow account with money stolen from Intrust account holders and paid much of this money to Stewart or for Stewart's benefit. Specifically, Intercounty paid at least $12 million of Intrust's money directly to Stewart and $15.1 million to others for Stewart's benefit. Now, this appeal is about whether it was proper, given these allegations, for the district court to dismiss the receiver's complaint. And in granting a Rule 12b-6 dismissal of the receiver's initial complaint with prejudice, the district court, we believe, committed two primary errors. Number one, it misinterpreted and misapplied Illinois adverse domination law. And number two, it erroneously concluded that a few sentences in just four paragraphs of the complaint made it impossible for the receiver to establish a conspiracy claim. As to the first error, the scope of adverse domination is a legal question that has been fully briefed. But let me highlight just a few points before moving on to the more fact-intensive issue of whether the receiver pled itself out of court with respect to its civil conspiracy claim. First, adverse domination would apply here because Capriotti and Hargrove, who dominated Intrust Board, would never have allowed Intrust to sue Stewart because such action would have brought to light Capriotti and Hargrove's own wrongdoing. Second, such a result is consistent with Lease Resolution Corp. v. Larney, the seminal case in Illinois on adverse domination. It's consistent with the Illinois discovery rule and with imputation precedent in Illinois, and it's consistent with how other courts have handled this issue. Third, there is no support for the district court's holding that adverse domination tolling can apply to non-director claims only if a civil conspiracy claim is properly stated against the non-directors. Even in Larney, the plaintiff did not allege a conspiracy. Larney itself was a one-count conversion case with no conspiracy allegations discussed or mentioned in the opinion. And the receiver is unaware of any court, other than the court below, that has imposed such a requirement. Stewart certainly doesn't point to any other case. Thus, adverse domination tolling turns not on whether a conspiracy has been alleged, but on whether pursuit of a corporation's claims would bring to light the misconduct of the wrongdoing directors. For those reasons,
would you agree that Larney didn't go as far as you're asking us to go? You're asking to dispense with the conspiracy requirement altogether, right?
Your Honor, we do not believe that Larney required a conspiracy. Larney, to be clear, Larney used the term conspirators, But because Larney itself didn't involve any conspiracy claims or allegations.
I'm not talking about a separate civil conspiracy claim. I'm talking about whether in substance you can allege and prove a civil conspiracy. Not whether it's a standalone claim.
Either way, Your Honor, we don't believe that a reasonable reading of Larney is that it required either.
I don't think that's a reasonable reading as opposed to just one of two permissible readings?
Your Honor, what we believe Larney said is simply that there has to be some connection between the wrongdoing of the directors.
Quote, we find that the adverse domination doctrine applies to toll the statute of limitations for a cause of action by a corporation against a non-board member co-conspirator of the wrongdoing board members.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You don't see a requirement of conspiracy in that?
We don't, Your Honor, because elsewhere the Larney Court focuses on this language that what's really at issue is whether or not bringing such claims would bring to light the director's misconduct. And none of the other cases that we've seen, and certainly that we cite to the court, require that a conspiracy be alleged. The court below read Larney as requiring a separate standalone conspiracy claim. And obviously Larney didn't require that because it didn't include such a claim. There was no claim at issue in Larney. In fact, there were no discussion of conspiracy allegations in the Larney opinion. So what there was is amongst the Larney defendants, there was a connection such that pursuing the claims by the corporation would have brought to light the director's misconduct. And we believe that this case is factually indistinguishable. It's not as if the money that was paid to Stewart had nothing to do with Hargrove and Capriotti's wrongdoing. So regardless of how this court views Larney, the facts in this case, when you apply Larney to them, support adverse domination tolling. And we believe that is a reasonable reading of Larney, and we believe that the court gave it an unduly restrictive reading. If there's no further questions on adverse domination, I'd like to move on to the second error that I believe we believe the court committed. Now, neither the district court nor Stewart challenges the sufficiency of the receiver's conspiracy allegations as a whole. Instead, pointing to just four paragraphs of the complaint, the district court claimed that the receiver had pled itself out of court. But a de novo review of these paragraphs makes clear that nothing of the sort happened. First, paragraphs 141 and 144. Ignoring the rest of the complaint, the district court focused on just one sentence, the second sentence of paragraph 141, which is on the contained in the supplemental appendix, page 70. And there the complaint alleges, quote, but because Stewart had allowed Intercounty to fire its independent auditors after 1989, Stewart didn't know the details of how Intercounty had stayed in business. From this single sentence, really the second part of it, Stewart didn't know the details of how Intercounty had stayed in business, the district court held that the receiver, quote, specifically alleges that Stewart did not have knowledge of Intercounty's improper business dealings. On a de novo review of a dismissal, there's simply no way to conclude that this allegation negates every other allegation of Stewart's knowledge. Critically, not knowing the details of how Intercounty had stayed in business after it fired its auditors says nothing about Stewart's knowledge of Intercounty's wrongdoing, particularly that which was reported by the auditors prior to the dismissal. But even if it were appropriate to view these two paragraphs in isolation, they allege that Stewart, A, knew of an escrow shortage of at least $5.9 million as late as 1995, 5 years after the conspiracy is alleged to have begun. B, knew of Intercounty's unprofitable operations and other problems. And C, never confirmed that in 1995, Intercounty was filling part of the hole in the escrow account with illegitimate funds, even though Stewart clearly suspected otherwise. This is hardly a conclusive admission that Stewart knew of nothing improper. Moreover, as this court has held in U.S. v. Sophie, to be a member of a conspiracy, a person does not need to know or participate in every detail of the conspiracy. Second, paragraph 147. With this paragraph, the court focused on the second and third sentences, which are reproduced in a supplemental appendix at page 72. During 1995, I'm quoting from the complaint, Stewart sent its internal auditors to Intercounty several times. But Intercounty never would give them enough information or time to finish their work. These two sentences alone do not support the district court's holding that, quote, Intercounty obfuscated Stewart's auditor's efforts to conduct an audit and shows no meeting of the minds as to conspiracy. Indeed, this paragraph concerns Stewart's conduct in 1995, years after the agreement to run the escrow account on the float was reached, and demonstrates little more than Stewart's lack of diligence in conducting and completing escrow audits. Moreover, how does audit office obfuscation in 95 negate a 1990 conspiracy? It does not. And this begs the question, where did the court below find support for its conclusion? The answer is that the court improperly looked beyond the complaint to the Capriati plea agreement and the Fidelity v. Stewart opinion by Judge Norgel.
Well, let's back up for a second, if we could, Mr. Merrill.
Sure.
When I read those paragraphs, I get the impression that your claim on behalf of the receiver is really that Stewart should have seen trouble signs, knew of some trouble signs, should have looked for more. It sounds like a negligence claim against a defendant who did not owe any duty to your client. What's wrong with that view?
What's wrong with that view, Your Honor, is I think that accepts the district court and Stewart's characterization of the complaint and ignores many of the well-pled allegations in the complaint, which indicate not that Stewart just sat by and did their business and just didn't happen and noticed a few bad things and didn't happen to notice others, but that as of 1990, Stewart knew that Hargrove and Capriati had engaged in criminal misconduct with respect to escrow funds. We've got a list in the complaint of $25.8 million worth of escrow abuses that were disclosed to Stewart. And we've got transcripts that we allege in the complaint of Stewart's CEO being aware that they had taken other people's money, escrow funds, and used them to buy office buildings, to invest in related businesses, to buy junk bonds, to pledge as collateral for corporate obligations. This isn't just, you know, a typical escrow shortage. This is fraudulent and criminal conduct that Hargrove and Capriati went to jail for.
We know that, yeah. But how do you get Stewart as a co-conspirator?
Well, Stewart's a co-conspirator because all of the details concerning this fraud and concerning Hargrove and Capriati, concerning the $25.8 million worth of Hargrove and Capriati's fraud, were disclosed to Stewart in the financial statements. Okay, at that time, Stewart had a $25.8 million problem. Because Intercounty, it also, in addition to knowing of the hole, it knew that Intercounty, Hargrove, and Capriati didn't have the resources to fill this hole. And what it did is it ignored normal industry practices of shutting down an escrow account when it's being operated on the float and in a criminal manner. And it said, we're going to allow you to keep this open. We're going to continue to issue title insurance policies and insured closing protection letters long enough so that you can find a source of funds to get in this account that we don't insure. That's the allegation of the conspiracy. It's not that they simply sat back and didn't know. It's that they knew exactly what was going on. They agreed to participate in the conspiracy to run the escrow account on the float, which this court has called a Ponzi scheme in other cases.
When did Stewart, Mr. Merrill, become aware of it? What year are you suggesting Stewart knows of the $27 million plus?
It was $25.8 million, Your Honor, and Stewart received financial statements from Intercounty, audited financial statement for the years 1986, 1987, and 1988. And then it received a reviewed financial statement by an outside auditor in 1989. Now, those four financial statements over time illuminated all of the $25.8 million. By the time you got that fourth financial statement, which they received in early 1990, the four financial statements together disclosed $25.8 million worth of escrow shortages, including conduct that really was criminal and was later prosecuted against Capriati and Hargrove. And interestingly enough, that was – and then Stewart began putting pressure on Intercounty, Capriati and Hargrove, to fill that hole. Normally, Stewart would have canceled and prosecuted. But as we allege, this problem was too big. Stewart was unwilling to face the entire loss itself at that time. So it pressured Capriati and Hargrove, who also happened to own Intrust. And Stewart, we allege in the complaint that Stewart knew about Intrust existence, that it pressured them to come up with a source of funds that it didn't insure.
So how is Stewart You've got to get an agreement. But how are they supposed to have known that that was the source?
Your Honor, it's not necessary for them to know that was the source. The agreement was to run the escrow account on the float. They've tried to redefine our conspiracy as conspiracy to steal money from Intrust. We don't allege that. We allege the conspiracy was simply to run an escrow account on the float. And regardless of who deposits money into that escrow account, every depositor, when an escrow account is short, is really a victim in that it's their money is being used not being set aside and used for their own benefit in the future. It's being used to pay someone that deposited money 3 months before. And the hope is for these wrongdoers is that they'll continue to get deposits so that they can pay back the people that deposit today. So that was the conspiracy, is to run the escrow account on the float, not to steal money from Intrust.
But your claim is based on stealing money from Intrust.
Our claim, one of our claims, for example, is an unjust enrichment claim. It does not depend in any way, shape, or form on Stewart knowing the source of the funds. Okay, in order to get unjust enrichment, you need a benefit to Stewart, a detriment to Intrust, and then either to show that the Intrust has a better claim to the money because it was their account holder funds.
Stewart's just a creditor.
Well, but there's a difference. If you look at the Intrust case that we've cited in an Illinois appellate court decision, there's a difference between trust fund holders and creditors. So, for example, if a bank closes down, just to give an example, depositors get their money before somebody that provided service to the bank. Okay, Stewart stands in line behind Intrust because those were trust funds. Stewart could never get its money out of the escrow account. These funds should have been in the escrow account. It can get its money out of Intercounty's corporate account if there's money left to be after the escrow depositors are paid. So there's a fundamental difference. In addition, Stewart was paid to take these risks as an insurer. And we cite a case that indicates that if you're a paid surety, you stand in a different position than someone who didn't take that risk. And finally, Stewart had the ability. Not only did Stewart know about these problems, but it had the ability to conduct an audit at any time, to receive financial statements, and to know everything it needed to know about Intercounty County. The Intrust account holders, and indeed Intrust, you set aside the domination by Caprad and Hargrove, never had that opportunity. So Intrust has a better claim to those funds under unjust enrichment. Another way to prove unjust enrichment is wrongful conduct. And we point to a number of instances of wrongful conduct. But the wrongful conduct doesn't have to be directed towards Intrust. The wrongful conduct could be, in our view, allowing it, doing its part to keep Intercounty in business while Intercounty went and found another source for the funds. So Stewart likes to talk about the fact that we weren't specifically aware of Intrust. Well, there's allegations in the complaint that they actually did know about Intrust. And given that Hargrove and Cavett,
they knew it existed and that it was under common control, right?
That's right.
Does it go beyond that?
Your Honor, what the allegations beyond that are that they knew that Hargrove, Capriotti, and Intercounty lacked the resources to fill this escrow hole. Yet they pressured them to nonetheless fill it. And they did so at a time when they knew that they had access to these Intrust funds. Now, this is akin, in some of the conspiracy cases, to leaving the room, perhaps, when some of the meetings happen, or to burying your head in the sand. They can claim, I suppose, that they didn't know specifically about Intrust, but we think it can be inferred from the complaint that they knew well about Intrust, and they were just happy to have money go into the account. They weren't asking any questions about where that money came from, even though they knew Capriati and Hargrove couldn't come up with it. So it's not necessary under any of our causes of action to prove that they knew about Intrust. Unjust enrichment at its heart is about a benefit and a detriment in either wrongful conduct or a better claim. And on any event, we've pled those elements. We've pled facts that support those elements. This is a 12B6 dismissal. We never got discovery. We never even got a chance to file an amended complaint. The court simply looked at the conspiracy claim. It applied its own view of Larney and said, you don't even get that far. And we believe that on this record and on a 12B6, that was simply improper.
You want to reserve some time for rebuttal?
I would, Your Honor, if you have no further questions at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Merrill. Mr. Kelly?
May it please the Court, Gerard Kelly on behalf of the defendants appellees. Your Honor, I think the with respect to counsel's arguments, I think one of the key things to do is to, we really need to understand first and foremost, I think this Court has, by its questions has shown it does, that intrust and intercounty are indeed two different things, two different entities. They did have a common ownership. But in terms of, you know, the way the complaint, when you first read this complaint, you see these, you see paragraphs where they talk at one point about intercounty and one point about intrust at this, in the same paragraph, unrelated allegations in a way that is, creates a lot of confusion as to what the actual allegations are. The actual allegations are, however, and this is, you know, absolutely clear, that there was only one point in time that there was actual knowledge of intrust, and that is this sort of serendipitous point which they allege occurred in the early or mid-1990s. By the way, this is after the alleged formulation of the conspiracy that they say existed as of 1990, when Malcolm Morris, the co-CEO, sees on the sign in front of Intrust, Intercounty's offices, an advertisement for Intrust, asks a question, is told, yes, this is a business that Hargrove bought. That is the entirety of the connection, if you will, between the Stewart defendants and Intrust. Now, the focus on this appeal, of course, is on the Larney decision. That is the one and only, counsel called it the seminal case. It sort of stands alone with respect to the application of the adverse domination doctrine. Counsel tries very hard, and they tried in the district court below, to deconstruct and reconstruct Larney in a way that writes that co-conspirator language out of there. But there really is no way to do that. In their briefs to this court, the opening brief, they say, well, the Illinois appellate court used that term loosely. In their reply brief, they say the appellate court used that term colloquially. They used it four or five times in the actual analysis and one point later on. I think these are not aspiring Hollywood script writers wanting to write for the next legal thriller. These are justices of the Illinois Appellate Court, and they know what co-conspirators are, and they know what a conspiracy is. One of the red herrings in the arguments that Intrust makes is that, well, the district court below ruled that you have to have an actionable separate claim for conspiracy, and Larney doesn't say that, and therefore that's a distinction. That's just not really what the Larney court says or what the district court said. It's not a question of is there a separate count for conspiracy or not. It's whether or not there are allegations sufficient to show that the defendant against whom you're seeking adverse domination tolling was a co-conspirator. And the only way to make that assessment under Illinois law is to look at Illinois law with respect to civil conspiracy. Counsel did not mention here, but in their briefs, they also talk about the underlying policy of the statute of limitations. And I don't think we should lose sight of that, but I think the underlying policy is different as the focus of their brief states. The underlying policy, of course, is finality, predictability, and the prevention of stale claims. And these are allegations going back into 1986 financial statements and what have you. We're 25 years past that. There's a reason
that we have to assume about 10 years of that, though, are attributable to you all. With the tolling agreement,
that's correct. The tolling agreement came in, more than 5 years past the last possible moment, but it was in 2001.
It has been in place for the last 10 years.
It's almost. We're very close to the 10-year anniversary, Your Honor. Okay. That's correct.
Okay.
But nevertheless, the policy implications of the statute of limitations had already come into play long before then. Now, with respect to what the Intrust complaint actually says, that's, I think, very important here. We did not, as counsel asserts that the district court below and that the defendants conceded that their conspiracy claims were adequate except for a few of these snippets and what have you that they take. That's actually not our position. I think you do have to read the complaint as a whole, and the complaint as a whole fails to establish a conspiracy. There are, of course, some of the allegations that counsel himself attempted to address, and I think it's very difficult to try to square the interpretation now being put on those allegations with the allegations themselves. Most significantly, I think, the allegations regarding the obfuscation of the audit. They claim in their briefs, and counsel again tried to argue that in paragraph 147 should not be read, and the district court committed error by reading that paragraph as alleging that Intercounty, that Capriati and Hargrove, obfuscated the audit. And what exactly does it say? It says, during 1995, Stewart sent its internal auditors to Intercounty several times, but Intercounty never would give them enough information or time to finish their work. It goes on in a similar vein. It'd be very difficult to describe that as anything other than obfuscation, and I think that there's no error by the district court in reaching that conclusion based on those and other allegations.
Mr. Kelly, in looking at that paragraph, was December 1995 the termination of the relationship between Stewart Title and Intercounty?
As they allege in their own complaint, because of the auditing efforts that were
undergoing. Is that yes?
Yes, that's.
Do you all agree that that in fact is what happened, that the relationship ended then?
That's correct. They stopped writing at the end of 1995. Your Honor. One of the things that Intrust does not argue is that you can indeed plead yourself out of court. And I think that's exactly what has happened here. They tried to argue below that it was inappropriate, but they now concede that it is appropriate if the complaint read as a whole clearly indicates that the statute of limitations has run and that no exception, such as the adverse domination doctrine, applies, that you can plead yourself out of court. And they have done that, not only in the affirmative allegations that they have made, but even more significantly in the missing allegations and the allegations that are contradicted by those affirmative allegations. And that has to do with the agreement. What was the agreement here? Where was the agreement by which Stewart entered into this conspiracy in 1990? Where was the meeting of the minds? What they say, one thing that they say is, well, it was, it comes from the failure to continue to audit. And in fact, they say in paragraph 102 of their complaint, this single decision, perhaps more than any other, allowed Intercounty to subsequently steal tens of millions of dollars from Intrust. But that's not an agreement by, as Your Honor observed earlier, merely not pursuing a right or a possibility of an audit or allowing them not to continue to have outside audits. That is not evidence of an agreement, a meeting of the minds. Similarly, the other thing is that they seem to be hanging their head on about the agreement is the find a, quote, solution, unquote, to filling the escrow. And they try to put a sort of a negative spin on that. But that's exactly what any underwriter, as the TRW case or any other one would say, any underwriter should be telling an agent, if you have a hole in your escrow account, you should fill it. And there's quite a bit of discussion as to what happened in 1995 with respect to Stewart's repeated efforts to insist that the $5.9 million hole in the escrow, which is what Stewart always understood it was, this $28.5 million number from the late 1980s comes about by adding up some other elements that were not understood by Stewart or represented on the financial statements to be, holes in the escrow, the defeasance program, which is a red herring, and various other things. But so where is the agreement? I would posit, actually, that there are two agreements here. One agreement on Stewart's side, the agreement is that Intercounty should honor its obligations and should fill the $5.9 million hole in the escrow. On Capriati and Hargrove's side, the agreement is we will steal everything we can from Intrust, Intercounty, Stewart, and anybody else, and we'll do everything we can to conceal it. But, of course, that's not an agreement to the same conspiracy. And that's the only, you know, when you cut through all the hyperbole in this, you know, 200-count complaint, I think that's the only conclusion that you can come to with respect to the agreement issue. Now, Intrust complains that the district court improperly took judicial notice of various other proceedings. And I have a few observations on that. One, as we point out in our complaint, the decision on the motion to dismiss makes absolutely no mention of the of these other matters. In fact, our motion to take judicial notice was denied as moot at the same time. It was only on the Rule 59E motion that the court mentioned these matters, and again, only in a footnote. And the footnote, you know, it gives a litany of the public record of this, the long and tortured history of the various cases that have come out of the collapse of Intrust and Intercounty, but it's not relying on that in its analysis. But I would point out furthermore, Your Honor, even counsel in his comments to you today repeatedly talked about the criminal activity of Hargrove and Capriati. They repeatedly cite that in their complaint. And of course, if you're citing, as we point out in our brief, if you're citing to these things, it is fair to bring before the court the matters or for the court to consider what you've cited. And so, for example, when they say, you know, Capriati stole money and pled guilty, in that very same plea agreement which they cite to, it mentions that he pled guilty to defrauding Stewart.
Do you think we could properly use that? Forget about what use the judge actually made in the footnote, but do you think we could take judicial notice of that?
I don't think it's necessary, but you could take – it's not necessary to the analysis.
As evidence of the fact that that Stewart was a victim?
No, as evidence of the fact that that Capriati was convicted.
Well, of course. Obviously, you can do that, but that's not really the issue.
No, Your Honor, and we never argued that it would – that we never argued that you should – that it was necessary, and in fact, our motion, as I say, was denied. And it's not part of his analysis. But it is challenging to hear these repeated citations to these and other proceedings being made in oral argument and also in their pleadings, and yet see the sort of cherry-picking nature of the approach.
Look, you guys were doing business with guys who turned out to be crooks, and, you know, this is the fallout, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. It certainly was, and we suffered for it. It's not in the papers, of course, but we lost tens of millions of dollars ourselves. Your Honors, if you will, one of the things that, of course, they're complaining about as well is the denial of leave to replead. And, you know, obviously this is a matter that is within the district court's discretion. There is obviously the case law that says it should be liberally granted. But what do we have here? Among other things, they cannot unring the bell of the various admissions that they do make in their pleadings. And that's number one. Number two, with respect to the exercise of the district court's discretion, this was a request that was not even made until the 59E motion, and there was no proposed amended complaint that was proffered. That is not necessary. It's not necessary to get leave to replead to do that. But in terms of what the district court was facing when it made this decision, you know, that I think is clearly something that is worth considering.
Can I ask you about that, Mr. Kelly? In the Northern District of Illinois, does someone who is seeking leave to amend, are they required to submit the proposed amendment?
No, they're not required. It is not a requirement, Your Honor, and that's not our position.
Okay. Other districts do require that, so that you don't just have a hypothetical discussion about what the amendment might be.
And I think that's right. And I think the better course, frankly, is if you think you can replead, to come in and say exactly what you could say. and they didn't do that here, but it was not required. But what we do know from what counsel has said and what they have pled is that PricewaterhouseCoopers has been the receiver for 10 years, has gone through multiple lawsuits, which is shown in its complaint with respect to the receivership, has turned over every possible stone. You've seen that in my own experience with the other litigation that was brought against Stewart with respect to this. And the suggestion that there is some critical piece of information that could solve the problems in pleading the conspiracy that is necessary for them to invoke the adverse domination doctrine is simply not plausible, if you will.
Can I ask you, was there other litigation between the receiver and Stewart?
No, we were defendants in the lawsuit brought by Fidelity.
Oh, jointly defendants.
No, we were one of the many defendants in that law. Fidelity sued Stewart and many others. That's the Fidelity v. Intercounty case. I think sometimes in their papers they cite it as Fidelity v. Stewart.
Okay. You prefer to think of it the other way.
Oh, sure, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay.
Well, and that's the way it shows up in the reporters. Simply put, you know, in conclusion, the district court clearly correctly interpreted Larney to limit adverse domination to co-conspirators. I think there's really no getting around that interpretation of that decision. And the notion that this court should extend that doctrine on its own, I think, is simply not well-founded.
Mr. Kelly, what if a tort is committed against the corporation and the one of the wrongdoing directors knows of that but doesn't want to pursue that claim because such pursuit would perhaps unravel and allow inquiry into the wrongdoing? Are you suggesting that there has to be a conspiracy there for Larney to apply?
You're saying that
there's a tort is committed against a corporation which is in the process of a lot of wrongdoing.
Okay.
And one of the wrongdoing directors doesn't want to take action to the benefit of the corporation.
Because in doing so, he would under Larney, there would have to be not just that he decided he didn't want to pursue it, but he would have to be engaged in a conspiracy. Because let's, for example, in your situation, say it's a tort. The tort was committed, you know, whatever it was, something was broken or there was some sort of an infraction. But if there's no connection between the tortfeasor and the, let's say, for sake of argument, the director doesn't want to disclose it because he was there and was an eyewitness and he was not doing something he shouldn't have been. I'm not going to posit what it is when he was there on a Saturday. However, if there's no conspiracy, if there's no connection, in other words, between the tortfeasor and the director, Larney says that there is no adverse domination tolling. And that's the law of Illinois, and I think it's the proper law because there's all sorts of claims that could be made against a corporation, tort, contract, other.
Well, Larney didn't actually address that question, though, did it?
Mm-hmm. Well, it didn't go that far. It applied it to a situation where it found that there was sufficient indicia that the company that Mr. Larney was, Midland, that he was the president of, was involved in a conspiracy.
It really didn't address the question that Judge Flom has asked, which is I understood to be more of a policy question about about how we predict what Illinois law would be based on its broader policies about providing ample relief and relief from the statute of limitations where wrongdoers are in charge.
That's right. And I understood it as such. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear, but I do think the policy of Illinois is, the statute of limitations is the policy, and then adverse domination doctrine is the exception. And they, if it's not within an enumerated exception, it should not, you know, at this point in time anyway, there is no tolling of, under the adverse domination doctrine. And in the situation posited there, if there's a sort of a serendipitous overlap but not a connection between the wrongdoer, Illinois law has not yet been extended to carve that out of the statute of limitations, and as a policy matter, I don't believe that it should. If there are no further questions, thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Merrill?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, looking at Larney, page 172 and 173 of the opinion, there's language in Larney that suggests that a board could not be expected to file suit against a non-board member co-conspirator because such action would necessarily bring to light its own wrongdoing and would be adverse to its own interests. So we believe that in the hypothetical you mentioned, Judge Flom, that Larney would apply in adverse domination. And it's also because on 173 it talks about knowledge, ability, and motivation. That it tolls, adverse domination tolls claims so long as there's no one that has the knowledge, ability, and motivation to pursue the claims. In terms of interest, I would just encourage the court to look at paragraph 111 of the complaint, which alleges that by 1990, Stewart had become aware of Intercounty's willingness to misuse escrow funds and also knew that the only untapped escrow account controlled by Intercounty was the one containing the funds of Intrust clients. So I think we do allege more than Stewart would like to admit before this court. And then finally, in terms of an agreement, as Stewart's agent, Intercounty ran a massive Ponzi scheme for years.
So back to 111. Apparently there's some disagreement here. How did Stewart know in 1990 that the only untapped escrow account controlled by Intercounty was the Intrust accounts?
Well, Your Honor, it's not entirely clear to us because this is Stewart's CEO's testimony of this.
He's describing something that happened several years later.
Well, we indicate that it was sometime in, I believe, in the early to mid-90s. It's unclear
right.
to us. It could have been
but,
as early as 1990. We don't know.
But in the preceding sentence, you allege quite specifically that Stewart knew that the only untapped escrow account was Intrust.
In addition to this little instance where Stewart's co-CEO saw the marquee at Intercounty, which we're not clear when that happened, Intercounty for a time when Stewart was a shareholder owned a portion of Intrust. So Stewart, for several years, indirectly owned a portion of Intrust. Now,
wait a second. Okay. Stewart owned a portion of Intercounty.
And Intercounty owned a portion of Intrust.
But how do we know they knew about Intrust?
Your Honor, that's the allegation in the complaint is that's what the state of
you're saying
ownership
they knew
was.
It. I'm asking you your basis for making that allegation.
And it's based on that knowledge and based on we believe that it was well known within the community at the time that Capriati and Hargrove owned this. This allegation may have been when the CEO found out, but Intrust also had offices within Intercounty's offices. So this is something that we discussed throughout the complaint. This is only a complaint. It's a 12B6 dismissal. We believe that the allegations ought to be fairly interpreted in a light most favorable to the receiver and that the district court's decision ought to be reversed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Merrill. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.